is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Would you like to talk with Zorba? Do you have a question for Zorba? Call this number, 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, in addition to our excellent callers, we have some good research.
Yes. Don't count your calories when you're on the treadmill, because if you look at the treadmill at that little printout that tells you how many calories you're burning off, it may be wrong.
Okay, we'll find out about that. And
anti-cholesterol drug Vytorin, is it good? Is it bad? What should you do if you're on it? Should you stay on it?
Some recent research. Kind of dunning Vytorin.
Well, interesting research. We'll talk about that.
Okay.
We'll talk about it.
And our recipe.
Robin's Southwest Chicken Wraps. It is a listener recipe. It is delicious.
And we have a fun medical myth buster from a listener coming up later in the hour. You're going to want to stay tuned here to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, we appreciate it. How can we help?
All right. I am a 20-year-old, and I'm a student here at UW-Madison, mm-hmm. and I just finished my first half marathon a couple months ago here, and I did a run-walk method. And the only problem is, during my training, I had a large amount of knee pain, and I have never experienced knee pain before in my life. This is really kind of a first thing for me to experience. And I ran the marathon with my mom, who's like 48, and she was in a better condition than I was when we finished.
Uh-oh.
So my question is, if you have any advice for training for half marathons, whether it be physical, nutritional, equipment-wise, to try to combat knee pain when training for a long-distance run like the one I just did, because I'm starting to get ready to train for another half marathon.
Is a half marathon like 13 miles or so?
13.1.
Did you win?
I did not win. I did meet the winners. They were from Kenya, and I speak Swahili, so I was pretty excited to talk to them.
Oh, exciting.
Wow, you speak Swahili?
I do, just a little. I'm actually taking Swahili at UW-Madison right now.
Oh, that must have been way cool. Way cool to greet them in Swahili after they actually won the marathon. That is totally neat.
It was cool. One of them even asked me to marry him. I mean.
So did you accept?
You know, I think my boyfriend probably would have been a little upset.
But that has to make you pause to wonder what you said in Swahili if he said, "Will you marry me?"
Who knows? A small slip of the tongue could have meant anything.
What's Swahili for yes?
Missouri is good.
That's great.
Anyway, help her out with her training.
Well, knee pain is probably the most problematic issue whenever we're doing any sort of a marathon. It's not usually pain in the hip until you get to be in your 50s, but it's often pain in the knee. And from an arthritis point of view, which you probably don't have, but from an arthritis point of view, knee is 4-to-1 more common than hip when it comes to that. But when you're looking at knee pain, there are a variety of things that can happen. It can be a problem with the patella, that's, you know, the kneecap. There can be a roughening on top of it. It can be an iliotibial band problem, which is one of the ligaments that sort of pulls the patella on and keeps it in place when you're actually running. It can be a quadricep problem. It can be a problem with the joint itself. It can be a meniscus. It can be many, many different things. But at your age, you really should be able to do this without having any significant pain. A couple questions. Was there swelling?
There was a bit of swelling, a small amount. I'm not going to say like my knees ballooned up, but they were slightly swollen.
Okay, so they were slightly swollen. And when you trained for this, how long did you spend training? How many weeks or months did you actually spend in training going up to this?
It was a 14-week training program, but I think I had 16 weeks when
That's a good amount of training. By the way, how much training did your mom do? Was she in the program with you?
My mom was in the program with me. She did about the same amount of training, although she was a little more hardcore than I was. I finished before her, though, so I mean,
you
at least I have something
her, and
to.
That's, And that's what counts in mother-daughter races, who finishes first. But what I think you have to do, really, is you need an evaluation of your knee. It's something that you've got to go in, see your family doc or see a sports medicine doc and say, what's going on with my knee? Sometimes an x-ray is taken. Sometimes an MRI is taken. Most of the time, it's not that at all. It's a matter of designing a physical therapy program that you need to try to strengthen the quadricep muscles. And sometimes it also involves wearing a band, you know, not an ACE wrap, but essentially a knee-type brace when you're actually running, which can be an elastic wrap. And that can sort of push the patella over to another, sort of push it over a little bit. And sometimes that can make a difference. And sometimes strapping the knee like you strap an ankle will make a difference. But you need a diagnosis, and in this particular case, you got to go in and be seen because there are many things. And, you know, you want to be able to do your run, jog, half marathon, and if you're training for it, you shouldn't be in pain.
Well, thank you very much. That answered my question.
Sure, and don't take this personally, but the next time you and your mom race, I'm rooting for your mom.
Oh, hey now!
It's an age issue.
Oh, okay.
I relate to your mom more than I do to you. Thanks a lot for
thank
the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, you mentioned exercise on a treadmill and the calorie counters on the treadmill. You say we shouldn't trust them, huh?
Well, I've got a question for you. You ever go to hotels, Tom?
Do I ever go to hotels? I have been to a hotel
once or twice. Yeah. Do you ever go into the hotel exercise room?
They have exercise rooms.
Well, many hotels have exercise rooms. Oh. Exercise rooms where people want to exercise in the morning, or people who think they want to exercise in the morning, but they don't. So you get on. I've done this numerous times. You get on a treadmill. You push a button there, and it tells you how many calories you burned. So I have always assumed, you know, if it says I'm burning 400, 500, 600 calories, that's just what I'm burning. Yeah. And hey, the night before, maybe I've had, you know, a little bit too much steak. If I've, you know, gone out, or maybe I've had something to drink, and I want to burn off those calories, I assume I can go there and it'll be right. But well, guess
so.
What? Not so. They're off often by 10 to 30%, and they can be off as much as 50%, according to the latest research. And they're never off on the low side. Like, you burn off 500 calories and it says 250. Uh-uh. They're off on the high side.
They tell you you're burning off more than you really
they
are.
They say you're burning off 500 and you're really burning off 250.
Why would that be?
Well, maybe they sell better. I have no idea why that would be. I mean, you assume, first of all, you assume that what they have is accurate. I'll tell you why, among other things. First of all, they don't take into consideration your body composition. How heavy are you? If you're walking on a treadmill and you're heavier, you're burning off more calories. Let's assume you're 300 pounds and you're going at 2 miles an hour on a treadmill for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
That's more weight that you're moving, and that's more calories than if you weigh 150 pounds and you're on a treadmill at 2 miles an hour for 30 minutes. In other words, because you're moving more weight on that treadmill. So it doesn't take into consideration your weight. It doesn't take into consideration your strength. Ride. It doesn't take into consideration your efficiency. I mean, so what these are is these are estimates. They've always been estimates on there. And it turns out the estimates are always off by 10 to 30%. And the issue is, and up to 50% in some cases, you can't assume you've actually burned off those many calories. And that's, when I read this article, I thought, you know, this explains why a lot of people say, hey, I burned off 500, 600, 700 calories at the gym and I'm not losing weight. I've made the assumption until now they burned off 500, 600, 700 calories.
Which apparently isn't the case.
Right. So you have to assume they may be 30 to 50% off. They think they're burning off 600, but they're burning off 400.
Uh-huh.
And that 200 extra calories can translate into 10 pounds a year of weight.
Yeah.
So this is not a small difference for people who exercise and are doing something.
Yeah. I'm guessing this is a topic that's of some interest to people who actually use treadmills.
Yes, who actually use treadmills.
Right?
Or who are actually exercising on machines. Yeah. Not moi, not you, but, you know, people are actually exercising on machines. So I think it's not, you know, it's caveat emptor, buyer beware. I think it's a matter of looking at those machines and saying, well, maybe I'm burning off 400 or 500 calories, but I might not be burning off that much. Look at your weight, look at your muscle mass, ask a trainer if you're at a gym, and they're more likely to give you an accurate answer.
800-462-7413. That's toll-free. We have a line open for you right now if you'd like to call. 800-462-7413. Here's a listener with us now, Zorba, in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate it. How can we help?
Well, I'm 34, and my wife's 36, and we've been trying to have a baby for over 7 years now, and we found out Christmas Eve, actually, that my wife's pregnant.
So, oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we're pretty excited, except now my wife is going through just having a horrible time with morning sickness and just overall blah feeling, and she sends me out on these trips to the store to get different kinds of suckers, and when I can't find the sucker that she wants, I'm scared to go home because she's suffering with the morning sickness, but I'm in just as much pain because she's mean.
She's mean.
Poor baby.
And so this call is for, you know, for her, but it's also for me too, because I was just, my question is there anything that that she can take? I know there's not medicine, but is there anything that she can take that will help with morning sickness?
Sure, and help you with her morning sickness.
Right. And most importantly, help me.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. We get it.
Exactly. And I'm not laughing at morning sickness. It's a serious problem. With some women, of course, it's much more serious than others. You know, it's interesting. There used to be a drug on the market that worked for morning sickness. It was an old drug called Bendectin, B-E-N-D-E-C-T-I-N. And about 25 years ago, it fell into the medical malpractice sort of melee that went on where people said it caused birth defects. It did not cause birth defects. Taken off the market here, kept on the market in Canada. I had women who crossed the border in Canada to get the Bendectin to bring it back because it worked for them. We're in Wisconsin. We're not far from Canada at all. They'd actually go up there with their husbands, buy the Bendectin there and bring it back because it really worked. And it went off the market here because there was a fear of birth defects that turned out to be unfounded. There is no pill as a result of that and others. There's no pill and there's no research on morning sickness because of the fear of litigation that occurs with that. And I mention that because it's interesting. You have a problem that affects many, many women when they're pregnant, some very seriously. No one wants to do research from either a pharmaceutical company point of view to make a profit or from an NIH, National Institute of Health point of view, because they have fear of whether or not it will affect the fetus. And that's where the issue stands. So we're left with the old tales of crackers in the morning, small meals, the food such as a high sugary food that can be useful with a sucker and so on, and women have to tolerate it. And it's a really extremely unpleasant thing. And for some women, it lasts the entire pregnancy. It's really awful. Nobody likes that.
Yeah. But how neat after trying for, you said, seven years? Congratulations again.
Yeah. Was there anything, what did you do differently? Did you go to a fertilization clinic? Or
We tried for 2 years, and we went to fertility doctors for about 2 years and was told that, that's not working, and we did everything up to in vitro. We couldn't afford that, and we didn't like the odds. And so for the last 2 years or so, 2 or 3 years, that I've been in school and graduated. She started school and just kind of accepted the fact that it may or may not happen, and we've been focusing on other things.
And bang, it happened.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And so you'll be real, real supportive as she's been for you all these years.
Yes, sir. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
A pleasure, and congratulations again.
800-462-7413. St. Louis, Missouri now. Hi.
Hi, thank you.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question. I joined the YMCA recently. And they have a dry sauna room, and they have a steam room. And my question is one of these better for you than the other, or is one better for certain conditions than the other?
Well, no.
Or are they both the same, as long as you sweat?
Well, as long as you sweat. You know, from a point of view of what it actually does to your body, you know, people have a belief system. Well, I go to the steam room and I get rid of my toxins because mm-hmm. you sweat. I don't know where these toxins are coming from. I mean, it's a concept that you've got heavy metals in your body and mercury in your body. And when you sweat in a steam room, the heavy metal and the mercury comes out and, you know, gets rid of your toxins. And that isn't the case. There are no toxins. You sweat. You know, you go in the steam room, you sweat, the sweat stays on you. You go in a dry sauna, you sweat. The sweat goes off of you because, you know, more quickly because the atmosphere isn't loaded with moisture.
There's no health benefit to either.
You go
in
a hot tub. Well, it makes you feel good. I think that's a health benefit. Well, I think feeling good is a health benefit.
That's very relaxing.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a hot tub at home, and all winter long, I go in the hot tub 2 to 3 times a week. You know, I just often do it. I soak in the hot tub in the morning or in the evening for 20 minutes, and I come out and I feel good. Well, is that a health benefit? You bet it is. It's absolutely a health benefit. Does it lower my cholesterol or help my heart? Well, I don't have any idea. I do know that people who are under less stress, who feel good, who feel better about themselves, that makes them feel better, and they're much less likely to have heart attacks and strokes. I mean, feeling good about yourself is a health benefit. On the other side of it, you know, you're not getting the same value with sweating when you're jogging. You know, from a cardio point of view,
right.
If you're jogging when you're sweating, that gives you a totally different health benefit. So I think it's whatever you like.
Well, what about, I've heard that if you have respiratory problems, the steam room can help decongest. Is that true, or is that just a...
Well, there are a lot of people, when they are stuffy, if they have an upper respiratory infection, they go in the steam room and they feel like they can breathe a little bit better. The issue with chronic lung disease, though, is a different issue. If you have chronic lung disease and you go into a steam room, you're more likely not to breathe as well, and you'll come out of there because there is heavy. You know, it feels heavy to you, and it's highly moisturized.
In the commercial ones, you see signs, you know, warning...
The warning signs are because people can go in there and their pulse increases and they can't get rid of the heat because they're in a hot environment, and that can put an extra load on their heart. So people with serious conditions clearly have to talk to their doc before they go into a steam room, sauna, or a hot tub. But for most of us, hey, it makes us feel good, and I'm all for feeling good. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Our pleasure.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. Zorba, let's jump over to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox now and see if we can help out Steph from Louisville, Kentucky, who writes, when my husband comes home from his dart league, which is in a smoky bar, his clothes reek. I'm wondering if I'm in danger of secondhand smoke effects by breathing in the smoky smells from his clothes and hair.
Well, I've got the answer. You know, honey, you walk in the door, and as soon as he gets in the door, he strips off his clothes. They go into the hamper, and he puts on fresh clothes in the house for his wife. That's the answer. No.
Or they both strip off.
And they both strip off their clothes. That's right. Whatever. But no, the answer is it's not smoke. It's not smoke.
It's smell, the particles. But not
smoke, yeah. It's the particles of the smoke. There's no evidence that I've ever read that the smell of smoke on cloth, which is what she's smelling, actually produces lung cancer. It's in the environment, and it's what you essentially breathe in. So what she is doing is she's smelling something. She's not breathing that particular matter into your lungs. And frankly, I don't think there's any evidence of it at all. It's stinky. It smells stinky, and you don't like the way that it smells. But it's more of an aesthetic issue than it is a health issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a lifestyle question? We want to hear it. Just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our recipe is coming up.
Yes,
for
it's a fabulous recipe. Robin's Southwest Chicken Wraps Dynamite.
On the phone with a listener with a delicious recipe next here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, that number, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before we get to our next call, it is, of course, recipe time, and we are tickled pink to have on the phone with us from St. Louis, Missouri, listener Robin Corey. Robin, hi.
Hi there.
This is Robin's Southwest Chicken Wraps. And how'd you come up with it?
actually, we were going to have a much more elaborate and fattening Mexican dinner for guests, and my husband invited a few extra people. I knew I didn't have enough of that, so I kind of tweaked an existing recipe and came up with this instead as a supplement, and now it's a mainstay on our family menu.
Oh, how neat. So it turned out to be a success built out of potential disaster.
Exactly.
Way to go.
So everyone was happy, and obviously this is a staple. I love this recipe. It's a recipe that is great from a caloric point of view. When we look at Mexican food, it often has too much oil and too much fat and too many calories. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the problematic issue with it.
So as we go through the ingredients here, Robin, jump in and explain stuff if you will, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
So we start out with a quarter teaspoon of cayenne pepper.
A quarter little tea cayenne pepper. Now, we could tweak this, couldn't we, Robin, if
Absolutely.
We want?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In other words, Tom, the spice king, the hot spice king, is ready to tweak that and put in a teaspoon or 2 teaspoons of cayenne
you
pepper.
You got it. Like it.
If you want to up the spice, you can totally do that, or you could add some sliced jalapeno chilies when you're cooking it as well, if you wanted to.
Good idea.
Ooh, that sounds good. Half teaspoon of paprika or chipotle pepper powder.
I was going to say, that's a new ingredient for me. When I started the recipe, I was using paprika. I found some chipotle powder at the grocery store, and I really like adding the smoky flavor to this as well.
You know, and I have to tell you, I've had smoky cayenne pepper, but I've never had chipotle pepper powder. I have used paprika often, Hungarian paprika. So the pepper powder has a similar taste, but it's hotter. Is that what it is?
It's not hotter. It's smoky.
It's smoky.
So it's that kind of deep chipotle, which is so popular right now anyway. So.
Yeah, that particular flavor has become popular. It's interesting how flavors come and go, and they really become more popular. You see, once you saw the word chipotle connected to the word McDonald's, you knew it entered the mainstream of America. That's exactly it. I'm waiting for the brie cheese to go into McDonald's, and then I know the coffee bars are starting in McDonald's. So all of a sudden, all these things I thought were exotic are becoming mainstay. But hey, American food is always changing, which is great. A teaspoon of garlic powder.
Little tea. Garlic powder.
Half teaspoon ground pepper.
Half a little tea ground pepper.
Freshly ground pepper, I assume. It always tastes better.
If I've got it, that's my preferred choice.
Always better, yeah. You've got to have a big pepper grinder in the house to do it. Half teaspoon of ground chili powder.
Half a little tea ground chili powder.
So is it the chili powder you use when you make chili, or is it the hot when you make chili? Okay.
Yeah, my standard chili powder.
Half teaspoon of ground cumin.
Half a little tea ground cumin.
I've got a cumin question. Where do you buy your cumin?
Generally at the grocery store.
Okay. If
honestly.
You go to an Asian grocery store into the Indian section, or if you go to a Hispanic grocery store and look at the spices, you will pay one quarter of what you pay in a standard grocery store. I am shocked at the difference in the prices of cumin. Absolutely shocked that when I buy it, I can buy a big jar of cumin in the Indian food section and I pay almost nothing. And a little jar that I buy in the grocery store costs too much.
But doesn't it go bad after a while?
No, not at all. It's a dry spice.
Use it every time.
Yeah,
use
no,
it all
cumin
the time.
Is great. Doesn't go bad.
Right.
Doesn't go
okay,
bad. No,
all
no,
right,
lasts,
all right.
Cumin lasts for years. Right. Please, please.
Don't attack
please.
Me.
I'm always looking for
just
stress.
A question. Okay.
Okay. 1.5 teaspoons of fresh lemon juice.
A teaspoon and a half fresh lemon juice.
That's right. 1 tablespoonful of olive oil.
Big tea olive oil.
Extra virgin, of course. Extra virgin is what we like. 2 chicken breasts, boneless, skinless, cut into chunks.
2 chicken breasts, boneless, skinless, cut into chunks.
2 red bell peppers cut into strips.
2 red bell peppers sliced into strips.
1 onion sliced into strips.
An onion sliced into strips.
Now it says 2 ears of corn, kernels sliced from the ears. Tell me about this.
Well, when corn is in season, this is one of my favorite recipes. So I usually chop, I strip the corn of all of the husk and all of the little stringy things. And then I chop off kind of the wide end at the bottom so that it sits upright on my cutting board.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just run my knife down the sides. And so they're not regular shaped like you would get when you bought canned corn or kernel frozen corn, but it's so yummy, especially when corn is...
Now, this is 2 ears. If it's out of season and you go to frozen, how much do you put? How much do you use?
You know what? I would say maybe a cup, 2 cups.
Cup or 2 cups. Okay, something in that range.
Yeah. Kind of as your taste desires.
Yeah, as your taste desires. So, and then 4 small flour tortillas.
Mm-hmm.
4 small flour tortillas.
And some guacamole.
Guacamole.
Guacamole to top. So let's put it together. Mm-hmm. In a medium bowl, combine all of the spices, lemon juice, and olive oil to make a spice paste. Mmm, I bet that's going to smell really good. Add the chopped chicken to the bowl. Toss it to coat it evenly. Let the chicken sit while you chop the veggies. Then heat in a large skillet over medium heat the seasoned chicken, onions, pepper, and corn. You might have to add a little bit more olive oil if it sticks, although I tend to use Teflon skillets with this, and I'll spray it often with Pam to make sure nothing sticks together. Saute the chicken on all sides. Once it's cooked thoroughly through, serve it in the tortillas with a tablespoonful of guac, and you are in heaven.
And you may not need a full tablespoonful of the guacamole if you know, like, it depends, you know, how much fat you want to add to the recipe. I think you could probably do it with less.
That's exactly it. You know, and of course, the big point is this. If you want to lower fat off and you want the taste, you may want the texture. You don't have to use a tablespoonful. If you use a teaspoon, you'll cut down on the fat.
What do you serve this with, Robin?
Usually I'll get some fat-free refried beans, or maybe I'll make up some Mexican-style rice with rice and a can of chopped tomatoes with green chilies in it. Kind of mix them together when they're cooking, and I'll serve it with that. You could probably do a salad with like a lemon vinaigrette or something, and that might be nice. And you can play with the veggies, too. This is kind of a sweet and spicy Mexican dish, but if you wanted something with a little bit more saltiness, you could maybe do black olives, or you could add fresh chopped tomatoes to it afterwards, or some fresh lettuce. So it begs to be played with.
And maybe have one of those good bottles of Mexican beer.
That's what I was thinking of. Dos Equis. Dos Equis are one of the other good bottles, or Corona.
Absolutely.
or a Loco Blue
Tecate.
With that. That's right. And then you sit and this is great. It's a great recipe. It's a wonderful recipe for 2 to 4 people. And, I mean, it really serves 4, but this is a wonderful
recipe. Now, Robin, you're in St. Louis. You used to live in Milwaukee.
I did.
Do you cut the fat down when you go to St. Louis?
Well, I think our portions might be better here. Our portion control might be better.
I guessed as such. Thanks so much. Sounds delish.
Thank you.
And for sending us this winning recipe, Robin gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low-Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
For today's recipe, send a stamped, self-addressed, business-sized envelope to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip 53706.
And if you want this recipe to go, just go to our website. You can sign up for our weekly podcast, our recipe podcast, and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's zorbapastor.org.
Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I just have a question in response to something that I saw actually on the Oprah show, if I can say that. A woman had a 7-year-old daughter who was experiencing early puberty, and she asked Dr. Oz for reasons why. And I was really surprised that he didn't mention anything about hormones in meat and dairy products, because I've sort of instinctively avoided them for my own daughter by choosing organic dairy. And I was just wondering if I'm completely off base, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Zorba?
Well, and Dr. Oz is very good. Obviously, Tom does not watch the Oprah show.
No.
So he doesn't know. And we've done some work together. He's really a great guy, does some excellent work with that. But getting back to the issue at hand, which
there's something about doctors with a different name. I was
going to
say funny
name.
Names.
That's right. That's
Oz,
right.
Zorba.
That's right.
You know,
right. Yeah.
It goes with
yeah,
media
connects together.
Somehow or other.
That's it. It connects together. Yeah. You know, you never get something like John Jones.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Dr. Jones. But getting back to the issues, first of all, there are a lot of issues about the hormone, different hormones that are basically in the food supply. And really, it has to do with hormones that are given for weight, steroid hormones given to beef cattle, and so on. But to the best of our knowledge, when we look at what the USDA has looked at, you're your body, when you eat the food, actually destroys the hormone with the gastric acid and the digestive juices in your body. It's not as if the hormone goes in and then goes into the body and goes into the bloodstream. That's the issue at hand. So a number of people eat organic foods specifically because they want to avoid even the possibility that this does not occur. I absolutely think that if that is I think that's a lifestyle choice, regardless of whether or not we have the science to back it up, because we don't have science to back up a lot of things that turn out to be true. I mean, but these have been studied over and over again, especially the overuse of hormones. And the feds have said we don't want to use as many hormones, antibiotics, hormones, other chemicals. When you look at factory production of foodstuffs, a lot of different chemicals that are used. So when we look at premature puberty, he may not have mentioned it because there's no evidence that that actually delays puberty or causes premature puberty. One side or the other. And as for the plastic issue, I don't think there's any evidence of that. If we look from a puberty point of view, if you look at what's occurred over the last 100 years, 100 years ago, the age that a young girl would first menstruate was 18, 17 or 18. And that's moved down in our industrial society to 12, 11 and 12 and 10 years of age. And nobody knows exactly why. There are a lot of issues that have to do with evolutionary issues. They think it may be because we have more protein, because when you go to societies around the world, when they have more calories and more protein, young girls menstruate earlier and have puberty earlier. And the same for young men. They also develop earlier puberty. So the delay in that is probably more related to the food you eat, the exercise you get, and then nutritional factors and genetics than it is to hormones.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, hormones from food is one thing. Injecting yourself with hormones would be some different.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It's a totally different thing. If you inject yourself with a hormone, it gets into your body. So if you look at growth hormone, which really doesn't do yeah. very much, although people think yeah. it does something, or a steroid, it does something. But if you swallow it, you eat it, the digestive juices from your pancreas and your stomach destroy those hormones. That's the present scientific knowledge as we know it. So,
but if I inject myself, I can hit a lot of home runs.
Absolutely, Tom.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. To a listener in Mankato, Minnesota now. Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I have a question about corn syrup.
Okay.
Currently, I use one of the large coffee creamers in a liquid form that's in the dairy case.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look at the label, of course, there's nothing natural about it. It's mostly water and corn syrup and quite a few different other ingredients that I can't pronounce. So I've been thinking about switching to a half and half and then adding and cutting it down by half with skim milk, and wondering if that would be a better way to go, even though there would be more fat and calories in that alternative.
You don't want to just throw in some 2% milk or something, huh?
No, because that doesn't taste good. I still want some flavor.
I guess
you still want some flavor. That's always an issue. Looking at the corn syrup issue, high fructose corn syrup has replaced sugar as the number one sweetener that we use in products because it's cheaper. That's what it is. And there are a lot of issues concerning it, whether it's more addictive or not. Well, it's surely habit forming. There's no doubt about that. And it's a matter of fat. Fat is also habit forming. You know, we like the taste of fat. It has a structure to it and a texture to it that we like. And once again, cutting down on those things will cut down on calories, and they ultimately make a difference.
Very interesting. What should she do with her coffee?
Well, you do whatever you find you can enjoy in your life. That's what I think. And so if you're using large amounts, if you're pouring in, if you're doing a large pour of cream, you might be getting 100 to 200 calories of cream in your coffee. And so reducing that fat, like you said, with a mixture is certainly worthwhile. Looking at a no-fat cream, which is a texturized product, it's a dairy product that's texturized and it has no fat. It has fewer calories, but it still has calories. That may be a way to go. And what I tell people is if they're concerned, you may want to measure it out versus just pouring it out. Because when I have coffee and cream every morning. I love cream in my coffee. And I know when I pour it out, I have no idea how much cream is in there. Because
right.
sometimes I pour out more and less. And so if you kind of measure it out, but I don't like measuring out because I feel like I'm being too scientific and it's not fun to measure it out. So another methodology is you pour it out of a, instead of out of the container in the refrigerator is you put it in a smaller container in the refrigerator in a smaller, you know, little pouring spout, and you can measure it visually versus on the big quart container, you know, or half pint or the pint container when you can't measure it at all, really. You know,
okay.
You pour out too much. It's these little things that make a difference. So from a weight point of view, looking at a way to do it so you don't drive yourself crazy, but using less calories from the cream is going to satisfy both your desire to stay fit at the right weight and enjoy cream in your coffee.
Okay, sounds real good.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I'm thinking, what's that song? Zorba, you're the cream in my coffee.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. It's the Tom Clark da-da-da-da Singing Show, and here's Tom Clark on Lawrence Welk.
Quickly now, Lawrence Welk. Quickly now, Zorba, you'll remember that not too long ago we were discussing the fish tilapia, which you thought was tilapia.
Yes, I do.
Guess what?
It's tilapia.
Here come the grammar police to show up to the scene.
You know, and we need music.
And
for
Deputy
the
Richard
police.
Informs us it's actually pronounced tilapia.
Oh, tilapia! Thank you, thank you so much. I've been sitting up all night, not being able to get to sleep, wondering tilapia.
I'm sure, tomato. I'm sure we've lost thousands of listeners.
Absolutely,
when you said, turning their radio off. How dare he, they
That's
said.
That's right.
Do you have a lifestyle question? We want to hear it. Just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Lots more of your calls coming up. A really interesting medical myth buster from a listener having to do with booze and joint pain. So you'll want to stay tuned here to Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Great to have you around. We'll be talking with our next caller in just a little bit. But first, Zorba, this one made headline news not that long ago. The study on the anti-cholesterol drug Vytorin, which takes Vytorin to task.
Right. Well, there are a number of issues here. We have to look at that study. We have to look at what cholesterol drugs do and why we take them. You know, the only reason to take cholesterol drugs is not to lower your cholesterol, but to lower your risk of a heart attack or stroke. I mean, that really is the bottom line. I don't care what my cholesterol is. I care if I'm going to get a heart attack or stroke. And we've discovered that by lowering cholesterol, it reduces the risk of heart attack and stroke. Not only that, but it's the issue of these cholesterol plaques that are on our arteries.
Right.
There are stable plaques and unstable plaques. An unstable plaque is one that's more likely to rupture and cause the heart attack and stroke.
And they showed in this study that Vytorin does not reduce that plaque any more than Zocor, and maybe, in fact, increases the plaques.
Well, it really shows that it doesn't reduce the size of the plaque as they measure the plaques. They actually went through, measured the plaques through a specialized measuring device, which used ultrasound to see whether or not the plaques actually regressed. Did they get smaller? And the answer was no, they didn't.
Yeah.
Now, the studies show on a consistent basis that Vytorin, which is a combination of Zocor, or called simvastatin, a generic drug which is now cheap, used to be expensive, combined with a name brand drug called Zetia, in other words, which is expensive, when you combine them together, it lowers the cholesterol more than the Zocor alone. Well, Zocor is cheaper than Vytorin, but the issue is, does it really reduce heart attack and stroke? That isn't what they looked at here. They looked at the size of the plaque, and the answer is, from a size of the plaque point of view, it doesn't do anything at all. It doesn't seem to make
a difference. So what's your recommendation now for those who are taking
First of all, it's one study out of several. And what happens is you have a study like this that it makes, because it's a $2 billion a year drug, it gets put on the news. Somebody comes on the news, and this, you know, for instance, chairman of the Cleveland Clinic went on the news and said, well, I would recommend people, not take Vytorin. Well, it's one doctor's recommendation from a study that went on from a prestigious institution. So does that mean mean that Vytorin isn't good? In other words, does this opinion count and make a difference? Well, I think the opinion counts, but I think it's something you have to look at, and it's once again only one study. Now, there are other studies that are coming out of a number of patients. This particular study looked at 700 patients with very high cholesterol with a condition that made them super high. Well, most of the people who are on cholesterol drugs are not on these super high amounts. They're on smaller amounts because their cholesterol is, you know, is a higher number. I think it's something you have to discuss with your doc. Do you need this more expensive drug called Vytorin, or do you need the cheaper drug simvastatin and make the decision right for you?
800-462-7413. Zorba, to a listener now in Bismarck, Illinois. Hello.
Hello, Tom and Zorba Pastor.
How can we help you?
I'm at age of 59 and a half, a few months ago, I went to a doctor for a checkup and had a bone density measurement. The results was in the spine, the L1 to the L4 was a minus 2. And, of course, the femur neck left, that was only a minus 0.5. And she said I had osteopenia, which you don't hear much about. But I was shocked because milk is my drink of choice, all meals, up to 5 cups a day, I don't know, gallons a week, no smoking, no alcohol, no coffee. I lift weights, not real heavy. I walk a half an hour every day, rain, snow, sunshine. I swim 3 times a week, and I was just really surprised.
Well, I've actually been diagnosed with osteopenia as well, which is not osteoporosis,
no,
but is sort of halfway, as I understand it, between nothing and osteoporosis.
Right, and that's really what osteopenia is, sort of pre-osteoporosis. And here it is. Like you say, why did it happen to me? I've done everything right. How could that happen? Well, that's a good question. We don't really know why it happens to you. We know that there can be a genetic predisposition. We know, for instance, that African Americans have less osteoporosis than Caucasians, and we know that these genetic predispositions make a difference. And we also know that here it is, you've done everything right, and you can still get it. And frankly, these are things that happen all the time with a lot of disease states. Here you have somebody who does everything right in a healthy way. Why do they get a heart attack? You know, why is their cholesterol higher? And the answer is, this is just what your body is doing, and you've done everything right, and calcium only goes so far, exercise only goes so far, and bang.
Let me ask you this. This is your first scan, is that right?
No, I had another scan a long time ago, and it was way above. They said you could, but I was much younger then and hadn't gone through menopause.
Right.
So my question, you know, like I said, how do you do specific exercises for the lumbar region?
Well, they're just like you can't spot reduce, you cannot cause bone to actually form in your lumbar spine. You can't do it. It's not going to happen. You've got osteopenia. The drugs we have on the market, like Fosamax, stop the progression of osteopenia to osteoporosis. Whether or not people now should be on them for the lifetime or for 5 years is sort of the bottom line question.
Well,
and that's right now is being bantered aboard in literature. Doing everything you're doing, exercising, making sure you keep up your calcium will help. But frankly, the drugs also.
I was told to pop some vitamin D.
Mm-hmm. Vitamin D is also good. 1,000 units a day. That's a very good point.
1,000 units?
1,000 units a day. Cheap, inexpensive. It's about $6 for a bottle, $7 for a bottle. That might help. But once again, we don't have, short of prescription drugs, we don't have a methodology of building up your spine. And the drugs don't do a lot. They increase it by 1%, maybe 2%, but they reduce the risk of having an osteoporotic fracture. That's what we care about. We care about the broken bones.
And it's not a given that if you have osteopenia, you're going to get osteoporosis.
Correct. And it's not a given that if you have osteoporosis, you're going to have a fracture. You're going to have a break because osteoporosis has other components to it, too. We know that people who have weight-bearing exercise who are good in balance, in other words, they do balance exercises also, are less likely to fall when they don't want to fall and have an osteoporotic fracture. But the question for you as a woman in her 50s is, should I take a drug to keep me from having problems in my 80s?
Yeah.
And that's something you have to sit down and talk about with your doc.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
800-462-7413. Zorba, time for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today from Bob in River Falls, Wisconsin. Bob would like to know if there's any validity to the old folk remedy for joint pain, which consists of eating 9 gin-soaked raisins a day. He claims that it has worked wonders for him. Or maybe he just thinks that it's worked wonders because he's soaked on gin-soaked raisins.
And this is an old wives' tale and an old doctor's tale that comes, you know, you take raisins, white raisins, red raisins, you soak them in gin for 2 weeks, you eat 9 or 10 raisins a day, and it'll help you, and it will help you through
Well, will
arthritis.
It?
Well, some people say it does. And,
I know, but will it?
Well, there are no scientific studies on it, so... I think if it helps your pain for arthritis, go for it. Absolutely. This is one myth that I support. The issue, of course, is if you're an alcoholic, obviously you shouldn't do it. But, you know, if 9 gin-soaked raisins a day helps the pain for arthritis, who's to say you shouldn't take
it?
The real issue is, do you have those gin-soaked raisins with breakfast or with dinner? That's really the issue.
This is the myth-buster segment, and you've got to bust this myth because there's no evidence I'm hearing you say that there's anything to
them. Now, raisins have resveratrol, which we know is good for the heart. Resveratrol is good for the heart. It's from grapes. We know that they have proanthocyanins. Proanthocyanins are also, they fight infection, they fight inflammation, so we know we have that. But on the other hand, when I did some research on this particular myth, I found out that the levels of both of these are undetectable within the raisin, that they are present in the grape, and 9 raisins are not a lot of grapes that you're actually getting. So I think from a myth point of view, yes, we have to say it's a lifestyle issue. The myth is tossed away and therefore solved. It is not true that gin-soaked raisins will reduce arthritis pain.
Do you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba.
How can we help you?
Yes, I drive tractor-trailer coast to coast, and I've been experiencing probably for the last, last year, pains in the back of my neck, and it causes headaches on the right side of my head. And it seems to do it when I drive. I usually do about 650 miles a day driving, and it's pretty unbearable. I try to massage the neck. I don't know if it's a pinched nerve in the back or in my neck area, but I'm just finding out if you have any suggestions.
Now, that sounds like more miles than states tend to allow. Am I wrong about
it? You're allowed 700 a day.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Oh, well, you're pushing the limit then, huh?
Yeah, I gotta make that money.
Yeah,
you gotta make that
I
money. Exactly. Well, when we look from a point of view of driving, there are a lot of things with a workplace environment, how you're sitting, how you're moving, how you're using your arms. There are a lot of issues that can produce pain in the back of the neck. It can be a disc. You can have discs in the back of the neck that cause problems. It can be the muscles, the trapezius muscles, or the muscles in the shoulder that do the shoulder girdle muscles. Both of those, when they spasm, can cause pain in the back of the neck. That can also be a problem. So one of my recommendations is to look several different places at the way that you're sitting. So do you sit on a cushion? What kind of cushion do you have in your rig?
It's a regular seat, but does have lumbar bags in it when it has air, so you can put the add air to it to support your back better.
Have you tried that in different ways?
Yes, I have. Believe me, I've tried everything because it's like I said, it's unbearable sometimes.
Uh-huh. So what do you do? What sort of stretching exercises do you do? Have you ever gone to a physical therapist at all to look at your neck?
No, and actually I should probably stretch more than I do.
So we're going to put, I'll tell you, if you come to our website, we're going to put some resources on the website for stretching exercises for your neck. Because one of the things you can do, how often do you stop? You're on the road, and how long do you, when you stop, what's the length of time?
I usually stop every 200 miles because I have a dog lady with me on the truck.
Okay.
Rides with me.
Okay. So when you stop, one of the things you want to do is you want to do these exercises because it's the stretching of the neck as well as the lumbar support that may help. So we'll give you some exercise to do. And that may make a difference because what's happening undoubtedly is you're pinching a nerve and you're keeping then the muscles stretched and then they become tense and then you tense more because the nerve becomes uncomfortable. And relaxing those muscles are the name of the game. Do you take any anti-inflammatories, naproxen, Aleve, ibuprofen? What do you take? Anything at all?
Yeah, but I do take them, but I didn't think it was healthy to keep eating those things.
No. When you're on the rig, you can do it. I would recommend 2 Aleve tablets before you get in the rig and then 12 hours later. So I would take 2 Aleve when you get in the rig, 2 Aleve 12 hours later. That'll reduce the inflammation in the muscles, and when you're driving, it's fine. So I would do both. Stretching exercises, as I said, it'll be on our website, and 2 Aleve in the morning, 2 Aleve 12 hours later. See how that works, and give us a call back and let us know how you're doing.
Okay, I appreciate your advice.
And good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. And before we get out of here, Zorba, let's grab a question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes to us from Rebecca in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. This one is going to stump you. She writes,
yeah, right.
I am the office alarm clock and regularly sneeze at around 4 p.m. daily. It's the office joke, because when I sneeze, everyone knows that it's time to go. But it even happens when I'm not at work. I'm fairly certain I don't have any allergies, so why do I sneeze at nearly the same time almost every day?
Do you expect me to know the answer to that question?
I told you.
I'm not a soothsayer. I can't see the future. I have no idea in the world why she would actually achoo at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, I don't know. I can make up some thoughts. Well, maybe she has, something that she eats at 3:55. She's taking her tea break. She's probably looked at that. Somebody comes by. The dog shows up in the office. I have no idea at all. But if you sneeze at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you're the clock in the office, that's good luck.
Thanks for stumping
me. And thanks
Zorba.
For stumping me. I have no idea about
this. If you have something strange nearly every day.
That is strange, let me tell you.
Or just have a lifestyle question, we want to hear it. Just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week.
A pleasure to be here, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Shocks Kohlberg is our technical director. Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer. And G.G. Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0126Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.